cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
You talk a little bit more about this jobs report.
Yeah, 8:30. I was pretty surprised. I was up there with Scarlett Fu. We were watching the numbers come through, and we were like, what?
I know, that's when you think, wait,
this
wait.
Is a mistake.
Exactly.
We thought that's what it was.
Like, wasn't it maybe 51,000 or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, it was out of control.
All right, so let's get to it because this is, you know, we talked with ZipRecruiter too, and they are seeing a strong jobs report and strong jobs market overall. So let's see what Becky Frankowitz is seeing. She is Chief Commercial Officer, President at Manpower Group North America. She is back with us, joining us via Zoom from Chicago. Hey, Becky, good to have you here with Tim and myself. So glass half full, glass half empty when it comes to the jobs market in your view.
Yeah, I mean, it was a blockbuster, monstrous number this morning that I don't think anyone expected. Like, we knew hospitality and leisure was coming back because our real-time data told us demand had dramatically increased. We knew retail was coming back, but I don't know that anybody would have said we'd have over 500,000 jobs created in January. So I would say always good for the American worker. I mean, more jobs are good for the American worker. I think it's an economic signal that it becomes uncertain what's to come.
Okay, so was this at all a surprise to you, given that you have such a good read on where the economy is, what employers are looking for, what employees are looking for? I mean, again, you admitted it, nobody saw this coming, but did this hit you the same way it hit kind of everyone else?
Yeah, so again, Tim, we knew hospitality and leisure was coming. We knew retail was coming.
Okay.
New health continues. Registered nurses are still the most in-demand job in our country. So we knew all of that. I would have said we saw demand start to come back in January, which, you know, is unusual, right? Because usually seasonally we start to see a reduction in headcount, particularly in retail, as they adjust from the holiday season. But when we started seeing that start to take off in the first couple of weeks of January, we knew it was going to be a very positive jobs report, and that it was. You know, the most encouraging thing I'll tell you is the participation, just a little bit of tweak up, but I'll take it because we need every person that wants to contribute to the economy working. So I was very pleased to see that, particularly for women.
You know, it was really funny, Becky. Matt Miller came off his show on radio at noon and is like, wait, Master, you know, pull up this chart. And it was non-farm payrolls. And he's like, you know, we're not supposed to see this kind of job creation in January. Just what you were speaking to, right? Usually that's when everybody from the holidays gets laid off. But we started talking about this whole idea of labor hoarding, something Tim and I have been talking about a lot with our guests. What signs are you seeing of that with some of your clients and customers?
Yeah, so Carol, I'll say it's gone beyond labor hoarding now. I'm calling it pandemic paranoia. So this overhang from the tight, very difficult labor market coming out of the crisis. Employers tried very hard to attract and retain workers. It was challenging. So they are holding on to their workforce with both hands. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we see all these headlines around layoffs. But if you put it in perspective, in December 2019, robust economy, jobs are growing. Layoffs were 1.2% of the workforce, December 2019. Fast forward, December 2022, layoffs under 1% of the workforce. And so even with the headlines, there's some rebalancing that's happening for some overhiring, particularly in tech. But make no mistake, tech unemployment right now in our country is 1.8%, 1.8 compared to 3.4. So tech skills are still in demand.
How messy is this report? messy in the sense of the data is going to be revised next month and it won't be as big of a jump.
Yeah, well, the revisions have all been upwards recently. So that's that was announced this morning as well. There's probably some noise, Tim, in it. I heard there's some noise around strikes, people coming off strike. But it's going to be hard to adjust a half million work job creation report down too far, even if it's adjusted. It's still going to be a blockbuster report, way above what we anticipated. And I think it will be interesting to see now if this is enough, again, to bring workers off the sidelines. Particularly in hospitality and leisure, another element of the pandemic hangover is we're seeing companies start hiring in advance of actually consumer activity. Retail, hospitality and leisure, getting ready for spring. And then they have a problem because they have to attract those workers that left, boomerang workers, back into the sectors that shut down during the crisis. So I think it's going to be a noisy path forward, possibly a little choppy waters, but this is an amazing way to start the year.
One area that has gotten a lot of attention from us and from a lot of the business press, of course, have been tech layoffs over the last few months at companies like Meta. Thousands of people laid off there, Alphabet, Amazon, and more. And I'm wondering if those are not how you look at those in the context of what you're actually seeing when you look at the data. I know we spend a lot of time talking about them, but we don't yet see that showing up in the data.
Well, I mean, because it pales in comparison to how much hiring happened in that sector. So it's pandemic hiring.
But are those people getting rehired easily?
Absolutely. I mean, again, tech unemployment is 1.8%. So they are getting scooped up either by other, mid-sized tech companies, and every company is now a digital tech company. So we're seeing people with tech skills hired in retail, hired in hospitals. I mean, every company needs those skills. So they're quickly being reabsorbed into the job market.
Hey, Becky, I do wonder, though, if maybe we're starting to see wage pressure subside a little bit. Is that making it easier for companies who might not be so sure about how the business market plays out this year that they're going to say, better still to kind of hold on to that worker, even if it costs a little bit more?
Yeah, so Carol, interesting on the cost a little bit more to hold on to, because our data would show that if you change jobs, and make note, the quit rate has not gone down in 19 months below 4 million a month, 19 months. So the American employee is continuing to have confidence in their own skill and the labor market. But it has been amazing to me to see the confidence people have in their ability to get pay. If you change jobs in the last year, you got on average, and this is average blue collar, white collar, the whole spectrum, 15% increase in your pay. If you stayed at your company, you got on average a 7% increase in pay. So while we're seeing muting in the overall numbers, actually I'd say stability, I wouldn't even call it muting, stability at 0.3% in overall wages, that we're still encouraging, the labor market's encouraging people to change jobs.
Is that unusual, that jump and that difference? I mean, I would assume that if you leave a job, you tend to typically get paid more. Just got about 20 seconds.
Yeah, what's unusual is the fact that we're not seeing any slowdown, even with all of the coverage on concerns for the future economy. No slowdown in quits.
All right. Always great to check in with you. Becky, have a great weekend. Becky Frankowitz, Chief Commercial Officer, President of North America at Manpower Group, joining us via Zoom from Chicago. Quit rate, she said, right? Hasn't gone below 4 million in, I believe, 19 months.
Incredible.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Couple that with the JOLTS data earlier this week, too.
Right. Shows the strength of the worker. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week right here on Friday.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, it is out on newsstands online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Of course, also on the Bloomberg Terminal. We talked about the domestic cover story yesterday. Well, the international cover story is about the billionaire son coming for WWE.
The billionaire is Shad Khan. You may know him. He, of course, is the owner of the National Football League's Jacksonville Jaguars and the English Premier League's Fulham Football Club. The Khan family's net worth, by the way, about $7.6 billion. The son, Tony Khan. With more on the story, here's Bloomberg reporter Kim Bassine. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. He's got a great beat. He covers celebrity and athlete business deals. We also got with us the editor of Business Week, Joel Weber, both joining us here in New York. So Joel, my big first question, is wrestling real?
Oh, that was going to be my big question. You stole it. It is
great
real.
Great minds think alike.
How about I improve upon your question?
That's like any good editor would do.
It is real. Kim, is it a pro sport?
Is it? It's a professional form of entertainment. That's for sure.
I'll take that. Yeah. And what I love about this, it's actually a huge, let's call it a sports rights business, right? Oh. WWE has owned this thing and has consolidated any past foe, except there's a little bit of turmoil at WWE, and along comes an upstart who happens to have a little bit of money to throw around. How is he competing with WWE?
There are billions in broadcast rights at stake here, and WWE is going through one of its most volatile periods in history. Tony Khan's brand is called AEW, All Elite Wrestling. They're trying to provide fans with an alternative, something that's not for lapsed fans who used to watch wrestling and then got sick of WWE. Give them something more, something fresh, something new, something else to watch besides the same product that's been on the air for so long.
But part of that includes bringing some of the people over from WWE. So how is it fresh? How is it new? How is it different?
There's been quite a bit of a talent war. So they're hopscotching back and forth between these two brands. We have them sourcing from the indie scene as well. These are like the much smaller little shows that happen. There's thousands of wrestlers playing these tiny shows across the country in places like, you know, bingo halls and nightclubs.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, it is. I've been to a couple of those. It is pretty cool. It's like a couple dozen people just watching them wrestle in the ring they set up there.
Kim, is this like the XFL going after the NFL?
That one didn't end well.
Right? I know it didn't.
Well,
that's
twice, by the way. The new XFL, maybe. They're working with the NFL.
Good point.
But now, this is the most well-funded person to go against WWE in 20 years. So back 20 years ago, it was Ted Turner and WCW, the billionaire going against the other billionaire. Now, this guy, Tony Khan, also has that kind of financial backing.
Courtesy of Dad.
Courtesy of Dad. Courtesy of Shad.
Okay. You kind of dodged the question here. You've watched a lot of...
Is it a sport? Was that the question?
Khan's version of this, All Elite Wrestling. So if I'm going to go watch All Elite Wrestling, what am I going to see that's going to be different than WWE?
A few big things here. More swearing. They will just curse on the microphone. WWE is more PG. Yeah. More blood. There's definitely more violence there. And more folding chair shots, like right in the back, just thwack, boom, ow.
Okay.
These are. I mean,
so,
it hurts.
So there's like actual
pain.
Wrestling?
there's definitely more wrestling. I heard this anecdote from one of Vince McMahon at WWE's former wrestlers. He went by Daniel Bryan there. And he said that Vince called him up one day and was like, what is AEW doing better than us? And so he spent 2 weeks watching all the AEW programming to see what was up. And he concluded that AEW just has more wrestling. They place more of an emphasis on like the craft of the show in the ring. WWE has more different kinds of segments, a lot more talking. And he said, you know, it's like watching a wrestling show with no wrestling.
How many hours of wrestling did you watch while reporting this story?
I went to two shows to watch them live and backstage and everything. That was fascinating.
I bet.
A little bit more.
You didn't answer. He didn't answer the question.
All right, let's give it a break. But is there an opportunity, right? When we've seen this before in kind of the corporate world, right? When one company could be the leader and they run into some trouble, whether it's financial problems or whether there's allegations against a CEO for misbehavior. And WWE is at that point. Does that provide, especially since AEW has some pretty deep pockets, an opportunity, a real opportunity to move ahead?
It does. There's an inflection point coming up. Both their media rights are coming up next year or so, and these are going to be the biggest deals ever for the both of them. So a bunch of names are being floated. Right now the battle lines are WWE is with NBC Universal, which is owned by Comcast, and then the AEW is with Turner, which is owned by Warner Brothers Discovery. But then when these rights are up for bidding, that brings in everyone else. We're talking, you know, Amazon, Netflix. We'll see who's really interested in some wrestling programming.
And that is ultimately, I think, one of the big reasons why I was interested in this, wanted to put it on international cover, is we are at a moment where sports rights only go up, right? Mm-hmm. The value of these teams only it's like goes up by billions, really. It's like, oh, it used to be $3 billion, now it's $4 billion. The rights are why the billionaires are buying them, right? And so if you can keep this off of someone else's network and maybe get yourself a buck in the process, it kind of seems like an ingenious strategy. And in this case, it basically, like, Khan created something out of nothing, right? And then goes poaching some talent. So how does he have to broker? What's it going to look like when this media circus comes to town to, you know, feast on these rights?
That's actually the reason he formed it, is because he heard from the guy who at the time ran TNT and TBS that he was about to, you know, consider bidding a whole bunch of money, like more than $100 million on WWE rights for Fridays. And he said, you know, maybe there's a better option here. I feel like there's demand. Those rights ended up going to Fox, and now TNT and TBS, they have his show. I think the big ones here are that Warner Brothers Discovery is likely going to want to keep them. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how high that goes.
Speaking of bidding and buying, our Sebastian Escobar, who is directing our show right now, reminded us that Tony Khan talked about or was considering, right, maybe buying WWE. Is that still a possibility? Just got about 30 seconds.
He will need a little help with that. I don't know if he can afford it right now.
Does Dad have deep enough pockets for that?
Analysts expect it to be up to $8 billion. So he would need some partners on that one. Cool. Let's pull it up.
Sell the football
team.
Get
in there.
Yeah.
Sports,
buy the wrestling.
Sports or entertainment? Have we decided?
Sports entertainment.
Put it together. Sports entertainment. He's right.
All right. Thank you, Sebastian. Also weighing in on it. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, here in our Interactive Broker studio, along with Kim Basine, reporter covering the cool stuff, celebrities, athletes, wrestling, and more here at Bloomberg News. This is the international cover story. Find it on newsstands if you're traveling outside the U.S. You can find it online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and always on the Bloomberg terminal. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit EY.com/reimagine to learn more.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, getting a bit of a break, I feel like, today is the tech trade, because it has been on a tear this week. You did have the tech bellwethers, Apple, Amazon, and Alphabet, posting results that showed an economic slowdown is throttling demand for everything from electronics and e-commerce to cloud computing and digital advertising. It was a little bit of a bummer last night.
It really was. Interestingly enough, despite the fact that you're seeing underperformance from Alphabet and from Amazon, Apple shares are actually higher. Let's try to make sense of it. We got Bloomberg News technology reporter Davey Alba joining us on the phone from New York City. Davey, good to have you with us. I want to start with just your big takeaways, how we look at this holistically, taken all together. What's the story that it tells?
I think it tells a story that tech companies are not immune from a broader economic slowdown. You know, tech is usually seen as this industry that holds strong throughout all sorts of ups and downs in the economy. But even these giants like Apple and Amazon and Alphabet were hit by the broader economic conditions. And, you know, I think that it's pretty significant that some of these, well, Apple was reporting the first quarter of not the sort of holiday quarter, but Amazon and Alphabet were. And even then, you know, when there's usually high demand for products in the holiday quarter, that was not the case this go round.
I think what's interesting too, though, you know, they were down last night. Apple's up 2.6% today. And we were reminding everybody that, you know, you really do want to listen to the conference calls and see if we, you know, either how they try to walk back the quarter or provide some optimism. But it's not like they fell off a cliff either. Google is still down about 3.6%. And Amazon, I meant to check on the trade, it is down, well, Amazon's down 9%. So that's pretty severe. I don't know. Is there a net in terms of what we got from the three of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think yesterday we saw, you know, the company executive sort of giving out the excuses, you know, that for their business's performance. You know, Apple talked a lot about how because of the strength of the dollar and sort of their supply chain issues, which are global, those were impacted. Alphabet, you know, sort of talked about how economic headwinds were impacting the business as its search product is maturing. And it really tried to spin things forward, emphasizing their AI products and talking about what's to come. But I think another piece of context here is that these companies are sort of down relative to the year ago period, which was when everyone was sort of, you know, still in the middle of the pandemic. There was like flush demand at that time, and all of these companies were flying really high. And so comparing it to this time 1 year ago, I think is kind of a tough comparison when you think about it that way.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Davey, I'm having trouble making sense of Apple today. It was, I'm going to read what Mark Gurman wrote on the live blog here, okay? Because this is like, you know, Mark knows a thing or two about Apple. Apple had an overall miserable quarter. Revenue dropped 5% year over year, including declines for the iPhone, Mac, wearables, home, and accessories. They missed Wall Street estimates for those categories along with overall revenue. Yet, shares up 2.6% right now. That's resiliency. What's going on?
I think it just speaks to Apple's reputation as a company that, you know, for all intents, like, basically is just so in the mainstream. While demand was not exactly, you know, sort of what they wanted in the last few months, it's something that they can sort of see picking up. And I think that the stock market knows that Apple is just a very strong company. And so we're seeing sort of the effects of that now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm thinking about the NASDAQ, man, the pop-up, you know.
The NASDAQ or ARK?
yeah, the new NASDAQ, as Kathy Wood called it,
yeah.
Which is kind of interesting, right? And I mean, I don't know, how do you, you know, Davey, it brings up a good point, Tim, because Kathy does look forward to who will be kind of the next players that will be very dominant in some of the developing technologies. And it does make me think about, you know, Apple, Google, Meta. Meta's going through its own transformation. They got a big pop this week. But, you know, time will tell whether this bet really makes sense.
Well, I'm trying to pull this up on the... Oh, go ahead, Davey. I was trying to pull this up on the terminal. And I think probably you and I are going to go to the same place, which is the comments from Alphabet, from Google CEO, Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai.
About AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about AI. You know, I think there are a few things here. Tech companies, for better or worse, are obviously at the cutting edge of, you know, sort of developments that underpin businesses moving forward. And, you know, Sundar Pichai talked a lot about Alphabet's commitment to AI, so much so that they're actually breaking out DeepMind, which is its AI sort of division, in the next company earnings as its own line on the company earnings report. And they're also, you know, making all sorts of moves like investing in Anthropic, which we reported on today. That's sort of an AI startup in this new field of generative AI. If you're not familiar with that, think about ChatGPT. That's generative AI because it generates text and other content based on a prompt. So that's kind of spinning it forward. And yeah, I think, you know, the future for these companies looks possibly good. The other piece of context is just that there was so much on these earnings calls about efficiency, about sort of slowing hiring, making more strategic moves as the next year comes towards us. You know, Mark Zuckerberg talked about kind of this being the year of efficiency for Facebook. And I think that that's something that the companies will really double down on, especially after we saw these waves of layoffs in the past few months.
Well, I want to point to the story, and you'd mentioned this, the story that you and Dina wrote about Google investing almost $400 million in that AI startup. $400 million, that's serious money. I mean, that's like, it's not, you know, pivoting to the metaverse money, but it shows that Google's taking this very seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they've also talked about their large language model, sort of their answer to ChatGPT coming out in the coming months. You know, $400 million is a lot of money, that's true, but it's actually pretty small when you think about Microsoft's investment in OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, which was $10 billion, you know, that we reported just last month. And that builds upon earlier investments of about $1 billion. So, you know, I think another thing to think about is how these giant tech companies are partnering with smaller AI startups to sort of stay at the cutting edge and forefront of these buzzy new AI products, which also in turn need them for computing power and resources and cloud capabilities, that sort of thing. So it's kind of a happy partnership for these companies at this point.
AI is not a new thing. What just happened, though, Davey? Good just got question. About 30 seconds.
Yeah. You know, I think that these chatbots have just made waves. And I think that they've been marketed very smartly and taken hold on social media. The underlying technology is actually not that new. You know, if you look at AI experts talking about these chatbots, you know, they've been around for a while. But the fact that anyone can use ChatGPT now, and millions of people around the world are, I think that speaks to sort of it really breaking into the mainstream these days.
Well, we definitely are talking a lot about it. Davey, thank you so much. Davey Alba, technology reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from New York City.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Inside from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Yesterday, we had a very deep dive with Kathy Wood of ARK Investment. She was all over her big ideas of 2023, more than 150 pages of big ideas. And it included five innovation platforms that are converging to create unprecedented growth trajectories. One of the platforms, public blockchains.
In our weekly crypto segment, our next guest has some thoughts on building better blockchain hardware. He's Michael Gao, founder and CEO at the cryptography hardware tech company Fabric Systems. He joins us via Zoom from Lafayette, California. Michael, good to have you with us. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. So explain what exactly you do at Fabric Systems, because when people think blockchain, they don't think of something physical, but you're working on building a better blockchain hardware, and that, of course, is physical.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. So what Fabric Systems builds is Fabric is building much faster computers designed from the ground up specifically for next generation cryptography algorithms. And when I say cryptography, I mean cryptography and not cryptocurrency. And there's a very, very big difference there. And we're going to talk about that.
Well, dig a little bit deeper into what you mean specifically and more of what your company is involved in.
Yeah, sure. So the main algorithms that we accelerate are zero-knowledge proofs and fully homomorphic encryption. And basically, those are a mouthful, but what zero-knowledge proofs are is, imagine that you walk into a liquor store, right? And then let's say they card you. You show them your driver's license, but basically you're showing them your home address, you're showing them your real age, you're showing them all these things that you don't want to show the liquor store clerk, right? And so what zero-knowledge proofs are, is it's the equivalent of showing just a certificate that a certain statement is true. For example, I'm over 21. And this has a host of applications in and out of blockchain. In the blockchain, it helps the blockchain link up to real-world applications like credit scores, insurance scores, you know, bank accounts, things like that, and makes blockchain actually be able to be useful for real-world applications. But even outside of the blockchain, you can think of it as a new point on the privacy trade-off curve where, you know, government regulators can enforce laws without invading privacy. And so it's this really exciting set of algorithms that cryptographers have developed really, really recently and have just gotten practical enough to the point where people can deploy them.
Where are you seeing this technology deployed right now?
Right now, it's on the verge. So, you know, it's not really anywhere right now. And the main reason is that it's just not fast enough. So in order to prove, for example, that your credit score is at least 750 or something like that, you would have to wait 12 seconds on a really, really powerful Intel processor. So that's why we're building, you know, much faster computers specifically for these.
It's interesting, too, and I think we lump everything together when I mean blockchain with anything and everything crypto. There are distinctions to be made, because I do think about, you know, the impact of the FTX fallout coming undone and Sam Bankman-Fried, too. What impact that has had on you as you move forward on the work that you're doing?
It's actually a tremendously positive impact. The thing I always say to people is that crypto is a problem for regulators. Cryptography is a solution. So, for example, you know, all these centralized exchanges in the supposedly decentralized finance world, like FTX, you know, all these exchanges that were essentially taking people's money, promising them an interest rate and not being able to pay it. It's a classic Ponzi scheme, right? And that has nothing to do with cryptography. And so what cryptography is a solution to those problems. So if zero-knowledge proofs had been around, and you know, exchanges were using them in the time of FTX, then exchanges would be able to prove that they have a certain amount of reserves and they can cover all their liabilities. That's actually a solution, not a problem.
We should note that Sam Bankman-Fried is still awaiting trial at this point. But a lot of the allegations that you mentioned have been allegations that have been made by officials at this point. Go ahead, Carol.
No, go ahead.
Michael, I was wondering about the hardware here, because when we think about hardware that's used in crypto, we think about hardware from like the big, huge names, right? NVIDIA. And you think about computers that use those chips. What is your technology? When you say you're building a better computer, what are you building and who are you competing with and how can you compete with those companies?
Yeah, our main competition, as you said, it is NVIDIA, and we're basically the NVIDIA of cryptography. So NVIDIA focuses on video games, on AI, on graphics rendering, and on a host of very important applications. And what we do is we focus on cryptography. And by building the computer specifically just for cryptography, we're able to achieve better performance on those algorithms at the cost of, you know, for example, being worse at AI computation, which we don't focus on.
So talk to us about time development and kind of, you know, it's interesting. Let me go back for a second, because I think when all of this was starting, this was like pre-pandemic, blockchain made a lot of sense to me, because I just think about that there's a lot of documents or transactions. There are things that we could cut out middle people, if you will, that it makes a lot of sense. But it feels like there hasn't been as much momentum. Has there not been?
Yeah, so the problem with the blockchain as it stands is there are all these unfulfilled promises that were promises made at the outset. When I got into Bitcoin back in 2011, you know, we were all talking about this, that, you know, one day we would cut out the middlemen and, you know, financial transactions and credit cards and all these things. And there just wasn't the technology from the cryptography perspective to make that happen. So, for example, Bitcoin can process a couple transactions per second. Visa can process 100,000 transactions per second. And only by using these next generation cryptography tools like zero-knowledge proofs can we actually use the blockchain and actually hit those you know, transaction throughputs, to name just one example, right? But even in the traditional finance industry, if you think about margin engines and under-collateralized lending and all these different things, you know, you can't run those on a smart contract right now. The computational limit is just too low. So that's why we're building dedicated hardware to actually fulfill the promise of blockchain, because in the absence of being able to fulfill those promises, the blockchain space has been, you know, kind of ridden with bad actors and scams and frauds because they can't really make something that's actually useful. And so we actually want to make blockchain useful.
Hey, Michael, you're joining us from California. What does your supply chain look like? Where is it? Where do you get components?
Yeah, so we have a really, really great relationship with a major semiconductor fabricator in Taiwan. I'm sure you can think of which one that is.
Does it start with a T?
And end with a C?
it start with a T. And then, you know, those chips get fabricated and sent to contract manufacturers in Southeast Asia. And then after that, you know, they come back, you know, in fully assembled system form.
Does the supply chain at all go through China?
No.
Was that intentional? Is that intentional for you?
It's really important in these times, you know, like when everyone's trying to decouple their supply chain, you don't want to be the one left holding the bag.
Hey, Michael, one thing I do wonder is in terms of regulation and oversight, and sometimes maybe we do need a middleman to make sure things don't go astray. So I do wonder what needs to be in place regulatory-wise for blockchain to really find kind of its full potential.
Oh, that's a really good topic. So basically, we've actually been talking to some regulators about this, but there's potential for regulators and actual blockchain applications to cooperate and strengthen regulation through algorithms. So one example is, you know, the SEC could require people to post that, you know, zero knowledge proofs that actual, you know, financial statements are accurate. They could require people to provide zero knowledge proofs of leverage, or they could provide, you know, zero knowledge proofs that if the bank goes through a, you know, major financial calamity, then it'll be okay, right? So you can even conduct stress tests using zero knowledge proofs without having to reveal your sensitive positions and all that information, and without having auditors just standing in the room looking at you, right? So it's really powerful. I think it's a huge opportunity for regulators to finally be able to enforce many laws that otherwise are unenforceable because of privacy concerns, because of cost concerns, because of industry pushback. You know, it's a case where we can cut the red tape, you know, but still have regulations that really have teeth.
Michael, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. He is Chief Executive Officer of Fabric Systems, joining us via Zoom, from Lafayette, California.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving, you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got less than 17 minutes left in today's trading session, and it's been an interesting one in a week that has just been full of so much. Of course, the monthly jobs report, and you are seeing stocks well off their best level.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth. and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Of the session, the tech names taking it hardest hit, really, if you will, on a percentage basis, down about 1.5%. Tim, we're still up more than 3% on the NASDAQ for the week overall, yeah, and up 1.6% on the S&P 500.
I'm confused.
Why?
I'm confused about the reaction to today's jobs number. Between that, the other economic data that we get the JOLTS data that we got earlier this week, and of course what we heard from Fed Chair Jay Powell, it seems that, you know, certainly the bulls are winning. And given that strength of the jobs report today, I'm surprised that I'm not seeing more of a sell-off. I think, you know, I was talking about this earlier with Scarlett and also with John Tucker downstairs.
Yeah.
And he made a good point that wage growth was in line with expectations. And maybe that has people kind of tempered.
That's one of the things I heard Mike McKee talk about earlier, that in terms of wage gains, and I think Molly mentioned it too, up, but less than the month before. Yeah. And so if we're seeing those wage pressures go away, that would be a big thing. That's the inflationary component to it.
But how does wage pressure, again, you always remind me, this is backwards looking. How does wage pressure go away when there are still almost two jobs for every one person looking? And people can just easily jump from one job to another job. And that's the best way to get a raise.
If people are getting nervous, Maybe they don't push so much. But let's see what it all means potentially when it comes to the investment environment. So let's get to it. Let's get to the drive to the close. Vance Howard is back with us. He's CEO and portfolio manager at the fee-only registered investment advisor, Howard Capital Management. He joins us via Zoom from Roswell, Georgia. Hey, Vance, nice to have you back with Tim and myself. What a week. I am exhausted. Tim's exhausted. It's a little crazy. How do you see all of what came at investors, including the big tech earnings, the FOMC meeting, the jobs report, sum it up for it, what it means for potentially the markets, financial markets?
I think it's great. I mean, I think that we've turned the corner. You know, our proprietary indicator, the HCM byline, went positive about 2.5 weeks ago. It went negative in January of 2022. So we've sat in a whole lot of cash up until the past 2 or 3 weeks, and we've been buying. The S&P went above the 200-day moving average. So on a technical basis, I think you've got to put aside a lot of the news out there and start trading what actually is happening in the markets, which is what we're doing. And we're a buyer. We've been buying quite a number of things. We've moved from about 50% to cash now to about 20% in cash, and we'll continue to buy into any dips that we're seeing. You know, today's pullback.
Wait, that 50% cash to 20% cash, how quickly did you move on that?
About 5 to 10 days. And so we started buying quite a bit of things over the past 2 weeks. And we've even started buying back the bonds. Our bond indicator went positive too. So we started buying, you know, emerging market bonds and long-term treasuries.
What was it that shifted in this rally? Because we've seen other rallies over the last year, and they've been false starts. I'm not saying this one's not.
Well, me either. I'm not saying that either, but you have to trade what actually is going on, and the trend has actually changed. We did have a false start about the, you know, right after the February, March area when the market wanted to rally right up after that big sell-off. But other than that, it's pretty much been kind of downhill the whole way down with a few minor adjustments, you know, with a few minor buying opportunities that would present themselves if you're a short-term trader. But this is the first time in the whole year that we've seen the longer-term trend turn back up. Not the short and the intermediate term, but the longer-term trend. That's a very, very positive indicator right there. And I can tell you right now, with the HCM buy line being positive, your odds are 73% chance it's going higher, 27% we get whipsawed. So at a 73% chance of moving higher, you take that trade, you start buying.
All right, you got to take a step back. For those who maybe didn't hear you last time, you talk about this HCM buy line. I know it's proprietary, but what can you tell us about it? You know, that it's an indicator that looks at what, so that our audience kind of has an idea of what maybe triggers it.
Yeah, nothing complicated. It's a trend indicator. It's a very sophisticated trend indicator that has a high level of accuracy. And like I said, it turned negative in January of 2022. Of course, we sat in a whole lot of cash, but it was still a rotten year for everybody, even if you're sitting in a lot of cash. And then, of course, but this is the first confirmed buy signal that we've had on the longer term trend of the HCM buy line. This is a very positive thing. So all this news that's coming out, I tell people, you got to trade what's happening right now because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Yesterday's gone. The trend's up. You got to start taking trades.
Well, it does happen next week because we do hear from a lot of Fed officials next week, including Jay Powell. And I've got to think, given his reaction to financial conditions easing, his reaction to rallies over the last year, sometimes he comes out and squashes them or says things that squash them.
Well, you know, he came out with a 25 basis point hike right there, and that was just a wonderful thing. His rhetoric that he had wasn't that negative towards the market. I think he feels pretty good about inflation starting to calm down. When you look at the PCE index, that's starting to roll over. That's been a big key thing that Fed Chair Powell's been looking at. So I think you got a lot of great things going on here. And the cash buildup, guys, I'm telling you, we watch cash buildup. This is the largest amount of cash buildup I've ever seen in 35 years of doing this. So this thing's got a lot of fuel to go higher. Mm-hmm. And if we...
What specific metric are you watching when it comes to a cash buildup?
We look at a number of different things as far as cash buildup, you know, money market flows that are going in just money market accounts. We try to look at that, and that number has been very, very high. So there's a lot of investors with a lot of cash. And you got to remember, too, this is the first year in 40 years where bonds have just taken an absolute beating. Mm-hmm. So you saw a lot of investors sell bonds and go into cash, but now they're ready to go back into the bond market or ready to come back into the stock market. And I think that's going to be a real big positive going forward in 2023.
Hey, looking at your buy list, just a couple things jump out. iShares US Technology ETF, also the iShares Semiconductor ETF. So you're all in, it sounds like, when it comes to tech.
Yeah, we were buying those 2 weeks ago, so we've had a pretty good run. You know, the past 2 weeks have been very kind to us. And I do like the ETFs better. Let me tell you why. I think that some of these stocks are going to take powerful jumps up, but they're also going to take a beating if they miss on any, like look at Snap. Snap got just beaten to death over there for their earnings. I think you're better off broadening it out with an ETF and not taking individual stock risk in a market like this, because a lot of people were hurt in 2022, a lot of fear out there. So just any kind of negative news shocks people and they'll pull the ripcord pretty quick on an individual equity.
Vance, good stuff. Love having you on the program. Let us know when you're back in New York. It was great to get you in the studio last time, too. Appreciate you taking the time.
All right, Vance Howard. He's Chief Executive Officer, Portfolio Manager at Howard Capital Management via Zoom from Roswell, Georgia.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.